Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, they're calling it a game changer. The federal government gets tough on medical marijuana growers and dispensaries. Some call it a betrayal by the Obama administration. And the next generation of entrepreneurs talks about Steve Jobs and how the Apple founder inspired them.
That was his power. He had this amazing ability to figure out what to say it, how to articulate it, and touch us to the core.
Also, it's like a tornado of migrating birds zipping down a chimney in Sonoma County where they spend the night.
Oh, it's mind-boggling. It's fabulous. I just can't even describe it. I love their chirping. It's like the stars in the sky, the way it's just circulating around. It's gorgeous.
It's the California Report. Will a new chapter in the federal government's response to California's medical marijuana dispensaries is underway. Friday morning, the four U.S. attorneys based in California held a press conference in Sacramento, outlining plans to crack down on what they call the illegal for-profit marijuana industry. Here's how one U.S. attorney, Benjamin Wagner, based in Sacramento, described it.
The reason for these letters is to put owners on notice that their property is subject to forfeiture if it is used to violate federal criminal laws. Our objective is not to forfeit the properties, but to stop the illegal activity. But if we have to forfeit properties in order to enforce federal law, we will do it.
Reporter Michael Montgomery with California Watch attended Friday's press conference. And Michael, we just heard one U.S. attorney describing what they're planning with this emphasis on forfeiture. That seems like a pretty big hammer.
Well, it is, and it's really something that's fairly new. The federal government has seized properties in the past related to drug cases, but here's what's different, and this started this week. They've been sending out dozens and dozens of letters to property owners who maybe rent building space to a dispensary, that's a medical marijuana outlet, or landowners who are renting land to growers, and they're saying illegal activity is happening in this area. You are been warned that this is the case, and if you don't stop these operations, you will be subject to possible forfeiture. That is a new tool, and I think it's gotten the medical marijuana industry here very, very nervous.
And Michael, are they targeting all medical marijuana dispensaries in California, would you say, or really the largest, the most flagrant ones?
Well, this is, again, something that's interesting. Over the years, they have focused on what I would call the sort of outliers, really kind of egregious cases, arguably, people who were really pushing the envelope, making a lot of money, maybe shipping pot out of state. Now we're seeing a slightly different tactic. For example, the Marin Alliance for Medical Marijuana got one of these letters. That is not one of these huge medical marijuana dispensaries.
And Michael, to what extent would you say, you know, are state and local officials cooperating or resisting with this, you know, from Attorney General Kamala Harris on down to the local cops and sheriffs?
Well, you know, we haven't heard from the state on this, and that's a very important issue. I mean, the state has issued guidelines. The Attorney General is supposedly working on a new set of guidelines for the medical marijuana industry. Obviously, all this started with Prop 215 back in 1996. But what the U.S. attorney said is that the aim of that ballot initiative was to help the sick and dying. And what they say is we're not targeting, that is, the federal government's not targeting the sick and dying. They're targeting this industry, which was not part of the deal originally that California voters passed. I think the advocates, and there were protesters out in front of the federal building when the U.S. attorneys were making this announcement, they're warning a number of things. But one of the things they're pointing out is that the state gets a lot of revenue from this. And I spoke to Dale Gerringer, a longtime medical marijuana advocate, about this.
I think it's a very questionable use of public resources when the budget is on empty for the U.S. Justice Department to be trying to go after medical cannabis businesses, which are generating jobs and money for the state.
Michael Montgomery, is that a legitimate point? How much revenue does it generate for the state or for counties?
Well, the estimate statewide is about $100 million a year. For counties, it varies. Harborside Health Center, the biggest dispensary in the state, just delivered a tax check to the city of Oakland for around $300,000. In tight fiscal times, that money is very important. And again, we're waiting to hear what cities and counties are going to say about this.
This is really, Michael, an evolution of the Obama administration's tactics on this. Going back to the presidential campaign in 2008, Barack Obama said medical marijuana dispensaries shouldn't be raided. Eric Holder, the attorney general, sort of confirmed that, and now we've got this. Any sense of, you know, why now? Why this evolution of policy?
Well, medical marijuana advocates are saying very clearly that they believe they've been sold out by President Obama. The U.S. attorneys in their announcement made it very clear that none of these memos from the Justice Department ever said that sort of a medical marijuana industry of this size was legal. They say that all the government was ever saying, the federal government, was that they wouldn't target individual patients and their care providers, and that they say they will not do that in this case. The question is, if all these medical marijuana dispensaries go away, will legitimate patients have an easy way to get what they consider their medicine?
Reporter Michael Montgomery with California Watch. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Scott.
Any short list of the most all-time influential Californians is sure to include Apple founder and CEO Steve Jobs. At a time of widespread cynicism and loss of faith in government, politics, and business, Jobs humanized technology with beautiful, fun, and cool products that transformed the way we live. It explains why news of his death this week, while not surprising, struck so many of us in profound ways we didn't really anticipate. Outside an Apple store, Patty Boone described her feelings this way.
He has directly and indirectly impacted all of us, hasn't he? In some way. Yeah, in some way.
We sent reporter Deirdre Kennedy to Steve Jobs' hometown, Palo Alto, to talk with people reflecting on his life and mourning his death.
People of all ages came to the Apple store in downtown Palo Alto to pay their respects. Software designer Alan Schiffman met Steve Jobs in a computer users group back in the 1980s. At the time, he found him arrogant, but over the years, he says, he changed his mind. He was sobbing as he told me why.
They say, once you're lucky, twice you're good, right? And he was like, he had like six times, right? He was like super amazing good. And he had a lot of good years left in him, I think. And it's too bad he didn't get to use those. Anyway, he did a great job with his life. He really made it into a piece of hard work.
And it wasn't just Mac users. Robert Yon made a point of telling me he's always been a PC guy. He works as a software engineer for HP.
Being a youngster, growing up around tech and making it kind of my livelihood, you know, to have Steve Jobs die, you know, it's like losing like a bit of a like a mentor, like in a way. You have to respect and honor him for that. And like he loved what he was doing. He didn't have to be there. He had plenty of money. And he just loved what he was doing, and he made it happen, and it's like the ideal dream.
Younger people like 16-year-old Rabia Damji said she couldn't imagine her life without Apple devices.
Steve Jobs has made a huge impact on my life because I've grown up using a MacBook for school. I've grown up with my iPhone, which I basically use for everything. I mean, I'm still very sad because he invented everything. He is Apple. So I'm sad about that.
Steve Jobs lived near the Palo Alto store and often dropped by. Patty Boone and her husband lived a few blocks from Jobs and his family.
We would walk by and we could see them inside cooking. And I would run into him in the sushi place in Palo Alto. He loved sushi. You just sort of stare and he'll smile, you know.
Boone says whenever Apple released a new product, downtown Palo Alto was like a carnival. Like earlier this year when the iPad 2 came out.
We just stood right there across the street, just watching the lines of people getting their iPads and walking out. So, I mean, they were just so proud.
The windows of the Apple store were covered in Post-it notes with condolences and inspirational messages in many different languages. Some quoted Jobs himself saying, "Stay hungry" or "Think different." Pixar characters were nestled among bunches of flowers and candles and apples. Angelica Atten, who works for Cisco, is a longtime Mac devotee. She says even though she knew Jobs was extremely ill, his death this week was a shock. She read a Native American blessing.
May the sun bring you new energy by day. May the moon softly restore you by night. May the rain wash away your worries. May the breeze blow new strength into your being. May you walk gently through the world and know its beauty all the days of your life.
The impromptu memorials continue to grow outside Apple stores and outside the Jobs family home in Palo Alto. For the California Report, I'm Deirdre Kennedy.
One thing said this week is that Steve Jobs defined the digital age. And there's no question he's had a huge impact on aspiring entrepreneurs. Thursday afternoon, several dozen of them intently focused on their laptops at The Summit, a cafe on Valencia Street in San Francisco. Desi Danganon started The Summit as a kind of incubator for startups, with office space upstairs where budding designers can share ideas, meet with potential funders, and dream about the future. I asked Danganon why he thought Steve Jobs' death touched people so deeply.
I think, you know, in America, we kind of lack a sense of spirituality. You know, religion doesn't play a big part of our daily lives, but technology does. And for those who really believe that technology is an all-empowering tool, they have lost their spiritual leader.
Sitting at a table toward the back of the cafe, Aaron Crayford is eager to talk about Steve Jobs.
Steve was amazing at figuring out our culture and the pulse of our culture. He had the innate ability to take an amazing amount of data points and figure out something that we'd all probably like. And that's what made him brilliant.
Crayford is working on a startup called Aloha, an app that alerts friends when they're in the same neighborhood to help them meet up. He's trying to imagine his app and describe it in the way Steve Jobs thought about Macs, iPods, and iPhones.
How this is going to bring people together. And how it's going to make people happier. How when you open it, it should be extremely visual. How the icon should be beautiful and bright. So whenever I'm making something, I try to think of Steve or guys like Steve and what they would probably do.
Another one of the young innovators here is Tyler Stalder. He works with a group called Code for America. They're building open source software for local government, using digital technology to make politics more transparent and participatory.
Kind of trying to take the design ethos that was imparted on us by Steve Jobs and apply those to governments. So that's been a really strong conversation inside our company.
Stalder said there's been a lot of reflection about Steve Jobs at work this week.
Most of us grew up on Macs too, so it's kind of been our entire life. I owe my career and my livelihood to the personal computer revolution, and that's the first part of Steve Jobs' very extensive legacy.
Several people have mentioned the commencement address Steve Jobs gave at Stanford in 2005. It was shortly after his cancer diagnosis, and he described how he dropped out of college and followed his heart. Kaisha Key from Berkeley works in the fashion industry. Key says she watched that speech again this week and found it inspiring and reassuring.
Personally, I don't have a college degree. I also dropped out of college, but then I also stuck around and just took classes that I liked. And eventually, I started to look back and see how everything was connected, all the things that I was interested in that I took. And they're very useful to me now. And to hear someone like him, the fact that he did that, it was like, okay, I do feel like I'm on the right path, even when everybody else thinks I'm crazy. So
this weekend, as we listen to our favorite music, download a new app, or watch YouTube on our iPhones, we can thank Steve Jobs for imagining our lives in ways no one else did. At least 18 people have died this year in Yosemite Park, a reminder that nature can be dangerous. Fortunately, visitors who get hurt there can find help at an unusual clinic of the United States Public Health Service. They typically serve more remote areas like federal prisons and American Indian reservations. But now, for the first time, they have a medical clinic in Yosemite. Alice Daniel paid a visit and has this report.
Lieutenant Tim Yett has worked as a registered nurse on an American Indian reservation and most recently in a federal prison. But these days, his commute takes him past raging waterfalls and towering granite cliffs to a timber and stone lodge where he meets patients from all over the world. Yett grew up vacationing in Yosemite, and when he saw the ad for this job, he nearly fell out of his chair.
And I go, I don't care what I need to do, but I am going to compete for this job with every inch of my being. I need to be there.
Yett is one of four clinicians from the Public Health Service who staff the clinic. They work in concert with the National Park Service, which provides building maintenance, payroll, and support staff. It's a unique partnership that started last year when the private company that had operated the clinic for 15 years opted not to renew its contract. Yosemite wanted to keep the clinic open, even if it meant starting from scratch.
It's an opportunity to get in on the ground floor and set up a clinic from the very beginning. I mean, that's very exciting.
That's Lieutenant Commander and RN Jennifer Leggett. She's unpacking boxes of supplies and restocking the supply rooms after a busy summer.
We have three different supply rooms. We have an orthopedic supply room where we keep all of our knee braces and things like that, bandages, lots of bandages for all those laceration repairs.
There are also plenty of crutches to go around.
Okay, there you go. Oh, you're doing better.
Yay.
Try not to do so much hopping. A little bit smoother.
Lieutenant Commander and Physician's Assistant Brian Burt is helping a 12-year-old girl from Israel learn to use crutches. She twisted her ankle in a stream and can't put weight on her left leg. Burt sees his share of sprains and fractured fibulas, but there's also the rare rattlesnake bite. This summer, a French visitor got bit near Nevada Falls. She had to be airlifted to the clinic, and anti-venom's not cheap.
That was about a $12,000 visit.
Burt's first assignment with the Public Health Service was at a federal prison hospital in North Carolina, where he gave insulin shots, regulated inmates' high blood pressure, and also sometimes functioned as a correctional officer.
All the staff in the prison would respond to the fight because it could get out of control very quickly and turn into a riot situation if you don't have the staff presence there because we're outnumbered.
Life here in the Valley is a welcome change, he says, but there are still plenty of adrenaline-pumping moments, like last week when a climber had an accident high up on El Capitan and severed his thumb. The thumb dropped 80 feet to a ledge, but the climber's partner was able to retrieve it. Search and Rescue called Lieutenant Commander Dr. Ralph Groves for medical advice.
And their question was, you know, how long do we have to save this guy's thumb, potentially?
With a window of 6 to 12 hours, search and rescue rangers decided to attempt a complex rescue using a technique called short haul. Two rangers were suspended from a rope 150 feet below the hovering helicopter. Using another rope, they were able to get to the ledge and extract the climber, who was then successfully airlifted out of the park. David Pope manages the medical clinic and also helped rescue the climber. He says the partnership is working because both agencies share a similar mindset.
When there's a need, you kind of do what it takes to get the job done. So much of the success we've seen that summer is directly attributed to the boots on the ground who have been making it happen. Sometimes 12 and 14 hours a day when the patients keep coming, even though we're in theory supposed to be closed.
As for the rescued climber, he flew home to Austria this week for the birth of his grandchild, thumb intact. Clinicians with the Public Health Service now wait to see what challenges the fall season will bring. For the California Report, I'm Alice Daniel in Yosemite.
Each fall, hundreds of thousands of birds fly along the California coast on their journey south. One species spends its nights in chimneys, creating a spectacle that draws onlookers from all over. Reporter Julia Scott visited a popular roosting site in the Sonoma County town of Healdsburg.
A few minutes before sunset, a small crowd gathers on a lawn at Rio Lindo Adventist Academy in Healdsburg. They've got picnic blankets and lawn chairs, cameras and binoculars. They're sitting around staring at an office building with an old chimney and waiting for something magical.
Bernadette Chadwick, and I live in Los Gatos, California. I was anticipating a chimney that was
a really old thing, like 100 or 200 years old with the birds. And then I found this building, very surprising, but it's so modern.
Chadwick and her family drove more than 2 hours for this chimney, or more precisely, the birds that are starting to converge around it. The Vox's swifts, one of four species of swift, are coming home for the night. They roost in chimneys, and for a few weeks in September, as they pass through California on their southward migration, birders come to watch the swifts pour themselves down into chimneys, sometimes 20,000 at a time.
It's very exciting just to, you know, anticipate the moment when they're going to kind of get into a huge mass and, you know, decide to go down into the chimney and give us all a treat.
And now it's showtime. After a meal of spiders and mosquitoes, the swifts mass into a living tornado. Hundreds of birds turning together in a circle, spinning clockwise, moving closer and closer to the top of the chimney. The sun is setting, and the swifts look like bats in the sky.
Oh, it's mind-boggling. It's fabulous. I just can't even describe it. I love their chirping, don't you? It's like the stars in the sky, the way it's just circulating around. It's gorgeous.
Suddenly, a peregrine falcon swoops into the column. Then, a few moments later, a Cooper's hawk dives in for the kill. This time, it catches a swift in midair.
Oh, he got that. Did you get one?
Yeah. Looks like he was carrying one off.
Brad Benson counted 1,200 swifts tonight, relatively low for this time of year. He's an administrator at this school, and he's part of a network of birders who track the swifts on their annual fall migration.
This is the Pacific Coast Flyway for migratory birds coming out of Alaska and south. And I think they've somehow discovered this chimney in 1989 when we stopped using it year-round for heating the water on campus.
Chimneys weren't always an attraction. For centuries, the swifts nested in the hollow trunks of redwood trees, but 95% of those trees have been cut down. That led the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to declare the Vox's swift a California species of special concern. Chimneys and smokestacks became the best alternative since they're big enough for the birds to fly inside.
They don't perch. They hang. And they're able to hang on the mortar between the bricks and line up like shingles.
Larry Switters, a retired science teacher in Washington State, was the first to sound the alarm over the fact that those old-fashioned industrial brick chimneys are now themselves endangered.
But it's reaching a point where there's fewer and fewer chimneys. And the birds are getting concentrated more and more and more. And eventually we're going to run out.
Switters has traveled across the Northwest, cataloging popular roosting sites, and he's created a website to track the swifts on their migration. He and a network of volunteers with the Audubon Society plan to use the data to preserve important roosting sites. Birders can catch the Vox's swifts as they descend upon Los Angeles next week at one of their favorite roosts, the downtown Chester Williams Building. For the California Report, I'm Julia Scott.
Being ahead of the curve is a blessing and a curse. It can make you a trendsetter, as was the case in 1996 when DJ Shadow released his innovative debut album titled Introducing. But what do you do when everyone else catches up? The California Report's pop music critic Steve Hockman has a review of Shadow's new album, The Less You Know, The Better.
15 years ago, Josh Davis, who happened to be raised in the city of Davis, released a true pop music aha moment, and not aha like the 80s Swedish band. His 1996 debut, Introducing, made under his nom de turntable DJ Shadow, convinced many hardened doubters, including critics, that music made entirely of samples, every sound on the album being taken from vinyl records, could be art, and compelling art at that. Now, with a generation of at least a segment of music fans having grown up with that album as a touchstone, it seems to be DJ Shadow's moment again.
I'm back. I forgot my drum.
At least in some circles, anticipation has run very high for DJ Shadow's new album, cheekily titled The Less You Know, The Better. It's his own fault. While he's kept visible via various collaborations and production projects, since Introducing, he's been pretty stingy with his own solo efforts. This is just his fourth album, and the first in a long 5 years. Of course, there's no way he can repeat his past feat, at least in terms of the impact. The good news is he doesn't seem to want to. Where Introducing was a complete, aesthetically integrated concept from start to finish, The Less You Know is, well, a set of songs, which frankly is a good news, bad news thing. In some places, it sounds like he's purposely trying to be jarring, such as following up the opening Back to Front with the metal guitar bombast of Border Crossing. It's a little more like border hopscotching going on here, as he distills a variety of samples and guest appearances into discrete explorations. In Stay the Course, with rappers Posnas and Talib Kweli, he sticks pretty close to traditional hip-hop.
From the first in hell, a child let out a cry. Some say, cause we in hell till we die. But what if that death is no sign of Muhammad, no sign of Isa? Just a pearly gate agent asking for your visa. We're back on your third rock, people trying to keep them heads up. You heard Pac. And bad time trespasses on your premises. Good times avoid you like a nemesis.
With singer Little Dragon, he goes modern pop rock on Scale It Back, a track that's earned considerable attention. Samples he sometimes leans to song structures. On Sad and Lonely, framing a 1940s vocal by singer-harpist Susan Reed with fittingly somber touches.
I'm sad and I'm lonely. My heart, it will break. My sweetheart loves another. Lord, I wish I was dead.
And the instrumental Run for Your Life has an edgy Talking Heads twitch to it. Is that Talking Heads in there? Ultimately, where introducing seemed like a million little pieces fashioned into a coherent whole, The Less You Know, The Better is 16 songs that happen to be on the same album, which is fine on its own terms, but suffers in the inevitable comparison. Now, Davis probably isn't happy that we're even approaching it that way, but when you make something that monumental, it's hard to step out of its shadow.
Steve Hockman is a Los Angeles-based writer who covers pop music. We review DJ Shadow's The Less You Know, The Better. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Racho. Paul Ancour is our engineer this week. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen, with help from David Marks. Pat Flynn was a contributing editor. Our interns are Rigoberto Hernandez and Rebecca Wolfson. Our producer is Victoria Maleone. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
Feel the way I do when I say.
This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The world standard for solar. SunPowerSolar.com.